Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
Hey, I'm Tyler.
And I'm KC.
And you're listening to
The Element Podcast.
Tonight, I need you by my side.
What's going on, all my woods people? For KC and I, we're heading into the weekend.
My goodness gracious.
We're recording this a little ahead of time because KC and I are going to be apart for a few days. Are you guys going on a little vacay?
You know, we bought furniture, and when I say that, I mean used furniture.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's going to let us be able to go do anything or not. Maybe.
Dadgummit.
We talked about maybe doing a day trip or something. And, two, we have the 3-month-old, so it kind of makes it a little bit tough to go and do too much. Also, everybody wants way too much for their little cabins during the middle of the week.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, these should be $70.
But yeah.
Either way.
We're going to go do some fishing, I think. But we're heading down. My parents got us a little kind of home-away deal for 2 days real quick down on the coast. So we're going to go do that thing.
That'll be fun, man.
I think so.
Hey, the Godzilla sand blew in today. Did you notice that?
No, but so I thought it was just a rainy, humid day. But I guess this is the dust mixing with everything.
Yeah, so that's the thing is, okay, this is a natural pattern. I think this is just a bigger version this year or something, so they hyped it up. But, like, that's why we get rainy weather in the summer is because the winds blow off of Africa, and that's how we end up with hurricanes and all this, right? But I think the world, or the United States, that's a very bad thing to say that we're the world. But you get it. Everybody thought that this was going to be like, you know, sand dunes falling on our heads. But no, that's how rain is formed by little particles in the sky. So it actually is going to produce rain and stuff. But I was outside when it was blowing in, and it was pretty crazy, man.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't see very far. You know, when I say that, like 600 yards probably or something like that, you know. But storms were kind of cool and stuff today. But it's definitely a different weird kind of day out there.
Yeah, I was doing church podcasts. We heard a little something, but not a whole lot. We were inside. So I did notice that it rained for a quick second. Is this supposed to hang around?
For a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For like a week or like longer?
I think, yeah, like 5 days or something. The extended forecast shows rain.
So is that going to be a good thing for me fishing?
I don't think it's going to be, it's not going to be like torrential downpours. It's just going to be like showers and stuff, which is pretty normal.
Wouldn't some overcast help usually?
Fish will probably be shallower.
That's what I like.
I like shallow fish.
I'm going to take my fly rod.
Oh, definitely. I mean, why would you not?
So, yeah.
It's definitely going to be
because I'm going to have 5 people in one boat is why.
Just get out. Bring your wading stuff and tell them, hey, if you see a good chance for us to wade, let's do that.
That's what my waders.
No. Don't do that. Watch the oysters, though, man.
Yeah.
Like,
I probably won't wade too much.
Something you got to watch out for is wading in sandy bottoms is good. If you run up on a place that's like got clay or mud, oysters are buried in that clay and mud. And like you'll be walking along and you're kind of potholing or postholing, I mean, like you do in snow. And then you'll posthole and then that oyster will go whoosh, up your leg.
That's good.
Yeah. Talking about a real good way to get some infection is by doing that.
You can get a oyster full. It sounds terrible.
But that's going to be fun,
yeah,
man.
I think I'll probably stay in the boat. Yeah, sounds good. Anyway.
Did you put on your diaper today?
I didn't.
Haven't done it yet?
No, I haven't had time.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the life of a church worker that doesn't get paid.
I thought you were going to... Y'all don't have a pole or anything in the church you couldn't... new fad... is to
indoor
saddle yourself, apparently, on social media. I see a lot of people. Yeah.
You remember when planking was a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what this is, the new thing. New planking, basically.
Saddling?
It's like just... Like, the next thing you know, there'll be people, like, with politicians just saddling on the politicians, you know? Like, it'll be just like, what can you get away with, you know what I mean?
Oh, man.
Like, what's the best saddle you can get away
with?
That's
funny. We're going to get in trouble for talking politics on the podcast by that one guy.
Thank God, man.
Sorry, guys. But we're going to stay out of the politics as much as we can today, but we have a really cool guest in Joe Salatin. This is a dude,
Joel, actually, but he probably goes by Joe. I don't think you added an L in there.
Man, we were talking about this today because we met a baby whose name was Willa, W-I-L-L-A, Willa. It's kind of an old-timey name. It's a real name.
Oh, it's not like a tree.
Yeah. Well, Cassie was like, I think I called her Willow on accident, and I was like, those are the same word to me. Yeah. Willa and Willa, that's the same thing. So I'm good. And maybe Joel and Joel is the same.
Yeah,
it
I
is.
Think so.
It is, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyways, I didn't know that much about him until you kind of turned me on to him the other day.
I didn't know that much about him until my wife started talking about him.
Yeah.
So I still don't know a ton about him, you know, but like kind of got some secondhand information from her. And so... yeah, we're going to have him on pretty soon. One thing to remember is that we are going to have several more of these elk hunting podcasts coming out on hopefully on Tuesdays throughout this summer. So if you're planning on doing a Western hunt, an elk hunt at some point, these will hopefully help you. It's just a little, you know what I think, what I like to think that this is different than all the other elk podcasts out there that you might hear mm-hmm. because... Not all of them, but some of them, a lot of them, because this is a couple of guys, one of which is pretty experienced in the elk woods for an Easterner, one of which is not so experienced as an Easterner, and then we always have, obviously, the expert on the other end of the line. Mm-hmm. So you kind of get some guys that hopefully you can match up with and, yeah. when you get to
it's
the
It's not
podcast.
Always guys who are trying to sell bugle tubes either.
Exactly.
Sometimes it is, and that's a big part of elk hunting. Like we had... Dirk on the other day, right? And mm-hmm. that's what he does, is he bugles an elk. He's called the bugler. Mm-hmm. But that's not the only way to kill elk.
Right.
So we're really trying to concentrate on that and talk about the different options for getting out west and trying to kill elk.
Yeah. So, but anyway, back to Joel. You know, this is a thing that we're doing where, you know, we could sit here and talk whitetail tactics till we're blue in the face.
We have
done that in the past. And I love doing that, and it's probably my favorite thing to do. But you mentioned it earlier, like, we do other things.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people out there trying to put out whitetail content. So if you want to go listen to some boring dude from, let's not say where from, but we all know where from, talk about, you know, his... How he rolls in the dopey, you know,
yeah.
or whatever before every hunt. That's fine. Go listen to him, and I think you can learn something. I've learned something from those people as well. But you know, this is kind of a little more in the vein of what we do, and I think other people could benefit from listening to stuff like this because, man, there's a lot of whitetail hunters out there. We talk to a lot of guys that don't get to hunt as much as on social media and mm-hmm. stuff, right? And so. The reason they're not hunting as much because they're working and they're mm-hmm. at home taking care of family and that kind of thing. And so, like, what a better way to still enjoy the outdoors than to you know, have a little bit of a homestead to grow things that you can be proud of and that you can eat and take care of your family with, man. It's a good lifestyle, you know, so it's not bad to talk about
and
it.
And have a good conservation ethic, you know.
Sure.
One of the things, Tyler talked about this a while ago, this is pre-recorded. We've already done the interview with Joel, so we kind of know how it goes. One of the things that's really impressed me is his knowledge of wildlife and ecosystems. Not just like, oh, that's a whitetail and that's a bunny rabbit or whatever, you know, but like the dude knew how stuff works.
Yeah.
He knows about like edge habitat and stuff like that.
I know. That was cool. You know, another thing I liked about him, as opposed to like talking to some whitetail expert, quotes, air quotes here, is that like, he was talking about managing the timber, and I can't remember what he said. I think I had it written on my computer at one point. But he said it in a different way, like something like managing the woods or something like that, you know? And I thought, man, like any dude in the whitetail industry would have called it TSI, but he called it like, you know, managing the woods or something like that. And I was like, man, the cool thing about this guy is he has some of the same like strategies, but they're not the same tired old adjectives or, you know, different acronyms and that kind of thing. So it's kind of cool to get a fresh perspective like that, man. So with that said, I guess it's probably a good time to get him on, let you guys listen to it. Joel has had a great year the last couple of years, really. He's really been on a lot of different podcasts and that kind of thing. So let's get him on and listen to the wisdom of Joel Salatin. All right, so now on the phone is a Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer, Joel Salatin with the Polyface Farm. What's going on, Joel?
Hey, just came in from baling some hay, so it's a good day.
Yeah, for sure. What kind of hay? Is it alfalfa or something else?
We don't plant anything, but whatever grows. This happened to be primarily, I don't know what, 80% white and red clover. So it was not tall, but it was thick as hair on a dog's leg and in great shape. Baylor ate it up. It was great.
That's cool, man. I don't know if I've ever heard much about clover hay, but that's pretty interesting.
Well, the cows sure like it.
I imagine they do. I imagine the deer would like it, too.
So my dad tells a story about baling clover where apparently if you let it get too tall, it can kind of just really jack with your baler. You got to kind of time it out right. Is that right?
Yeah, it can get kind of stemmy, but no, this was just sweet and good. And you talk about deer. In fact, the field adjoining it, as we pulled out with the last load here, as I came in to do this, there was a deer over there standing in what we hadn't mowed, and she was, I don't know what, 30 yards, and we brought the tractor and the hay wagon down, you know, and she just stood there and. She couldn't have been more I think they know when they're being hunted or not. They know when I'm driving around with the farm machines, you know, they're about as safe as anything. And so she just kind of watched us and stayed there and didn't move and kept on eating clover.
She's hungry. Dinner time.
She probably had a little fawn. Fawn over there about, you know, over in the edge of the woods. And
sure.
So she was probably happy for us to pay attention to her and not be snooping around the edge of the woods.
Yeah, that's sure. Well, I appreciate you doing this. I know you're a busy man. How's the summer going?
Oh, it's a good summer. We've had good rains, and for the moisture level at this point, it's been good. The pandemic, the COVID has been the best marketing strategy ever. If I'd have known it was such a good marketing strategy for local integrity food, I'd have ordered up a pandemic 3 years ago. But
okay. So,
we've had the best season ever as far as sales, marketing, customers. I mean,
sure,
we've had to ration food. We've been out of some stuff, and I mean, we just never run out of things, and my goodness, we even ran out of hot dogs. So
oh my goodness,
it's just, yeah, I mean, that's really bad.
You know, it's bad when that happens, for sure. Yeah, I bet you know, I noticed that you were on the Rogan podcast recently. I'm sure that didn't hurt you either with sales and that kind of thing. So
no, but I mean, the thing is, sure, some people called and wanted stuff, but I mean, we just don't have anything. We're trying to take care of our, you know, our old customers, our loyal people who've been with us. And so, you know, we kind of have to prioritize our customers and spread it as far as we can go. And it's coming up. We're gaining on it a little bit. But I'll tell you what, it's been an incredible crush, unlike anything we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's great, man. So, you know, I'm thinking you're probably reaching a bit of an ignorant listener base here with us. So can you kind of give an upper deck view of what you do and why it's good?
Well, sure. So we're in pastured livestock. What that means is we raise cattle, pigs, chickens, turkeys, eggs, ducks, lambs. But rather than putting the cows in feedlot and the chickens in houses and the turkeys in houses and the pigs in houses and the ducks in houses and all that, they're actually out on pasture. Now, the first reaction, of course, when you say that normally is, oh, okay, then he's overgrazing and he's making deserts and, you know, destroying the ecosystem and all that stuff. But first of all, yes, they are out on pasture. They're not in confinement houses, so they actually move. But the second thing is, we mimic the, you know, the wild patterns of nature and move them every day. So the meat chickens, they're in little shelters. We have about 200 shelters, 75 birds in each one. So I mean, it's in the backyard. You know, we're raising 45,000 broilers a summer. In little 12 by 10 by 2 foot high floorless shelters that we move every day, in the, you know, at the dawn in the early morning, chickens, you know, birds get up real early.
Mm-hmm.
And so we move them every morning, and so they get a fresh salad bar, fresh, you know, pasture. They get moved away from yesterday's excrement, so they get their bedding, their linens and bedding changed every day. I mean, that's real hotel service. And so, you know, it keeps them clean, hygiene, and that way we don't have to use any antibiotics, we don't have to use any medications, drugs, coccidiostats, or any of that stuff. The cows are exactly like the bison. You know, the bison move. They didn't stay in one place. They move for a lot of reasons. To find salt licks. They moved because predators were after them, like wolves, and of course they moved because flies were after them. And of course, they moved because they wanted, you know, new fresh grass. And so, we don't have wolves here, but we use electric fence, and it's portable. And so every day we move the herd of cows to a new paddock. So we might move, you know, 500 head onto 4 acres for a day, and then they move on, you know. And so they're only touching one spot, three or four times a year, rather than staying in the same field all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is it creates an incredible vegetative mosaic, so that rather than just the whole place being denuded or overgrazed or whatever, instead, by having them in these little tight blocks where we allow the grass to grow tall between times, it stimulates grassland birds, from, you know, meadowlarks to goldfinches to whatever. They proliferate because they've always got a place to go and a place to nest, and it really stimulates pollinators because there's always something in bloom because it's a quilt pattern, it's a mosaic, so there's always something in bloom. Finally, I would just say that the pigs are in pig pastures that are essentially silvo pastures. So these are widely spaced trees with grass in between. And we've actually gone up into the woods. We're in Appalachian hardwoods here, lots of, you know, upland oaks and, of course, walnut and hickory and all that. Lots of mast. And of course, these woods, you know, climax woods are actually fairly sterile. You know, there's not a lot of bugs or insects underneath. And so, for example, wild turkeys, little poults, baby turkeys, require about a 30-32% protein ration. Well, that can't come from seeds. It has to come from bugs, insects. And in deep woods, there aren't very many bugs. Bugs are in the bugs are in the prairie. Bugs are out in the grassland.
Mm-hmm.
And so these pig silvo pastures that we've created, by thinning the trees and thinning down the canopy enough to get grass underneath the trees, kind of a park-like look, that really stimulates edge effect, and turkeys are in there up the wazoo, and we now have, I mean, flocks of turkeys like I've never seen before.
You're talking wild turkeys, right?
Wild turkeys, yes. Yeah. Now, we raise domestic turkeys,
sure,
as well. But I'm trying to tie our domestic livestock. Here's the thing. So many times, commercial agriculture views wildlife as a liability, not an asset. You know, ducks bring in avian influenza. You know, deer bring in,
EHD.
Mad deer disease.
CWD.
And so, you know, you got all this demonization of wildlife. And so we actually believe that that any system that views wildlife as a liability is probably not a good system. And so a kind of a litmus test for are we doing good farming is measuring the level of wildlife, because if the wildlife is proliferating and even becoming more abundant, even alongside on the same land base as the commercial farm, what that means is you're probably farming pretty good. Mm-hmm. And so we're really grateful and thankful that our systems that we do be for ecological reasons, what works for the domestic animals is also a tremendous asset, you know, for the wildlife. So when we're moving all this stuff around all the time, you have to have water. And so rather than pumping water out of a creek or out of an aquifer or a well, we've actually built ponds over the years to mimic the kind of historical beaver ponds. A lot of people don't realize 500 years ago, North America was 8% water.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine, today we're less than 1% water. 500 years ago, we were 8% water, and most of that water was beaver ponds, beaver dams. There were 200 million beavers, and we now know by digging up skeletons, some of these beavers were the size of a Volkswagen automobile. So there were some big beavers, you know, and not maybe 500 years ago, but more prehistorically, more, you know, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the level of activity and riparian, you know, riparian development that these beavers did was phenomenal. And so we are pond building crazy people here. Every time we get a couple bucks in our pocket, we build another pond. And so we, unlike the beavers, we don't have to dam up a stream. So we can go up with excavation equipment up to a dry, you know, to a dry valley, and we can put a dam across that, and it only fills up with water if there's a flood or a hurricane or snow melt or something. And then we use that water throughout the season. So we have 8 miles of water lines coming from these high terrain ponds that gravity feed down and give us clean pressure water all over the farm. Now, obviously, all these ponds, they grow cattails, they've got frogs and toads and salamanders and, of course, ducks and all sorts of assorted ducks, and they give the, you know, wildlife a place to come and drink. So, again, we do the water so that we can irrigate with it and we can water our livestock with it, but then it has that positive effect of actually putting all these wonderful, you know, riparian areas scattered all around what would otherwise be literally, you know, miles to water in the summer.
Right. Right. So it sounds like you know, this is something that the reason that I kind of wanted to have you on is because you my wife is a fan, so that's I had to. But
that's how we get her to listen to our podcast.
Exactly. Yeah, we get one download from her. So no, it's you know, one thing that I hear because she likes she reads your books and watches everything on YouTube, listens to your podcasts that you've done and that kind of thing. I get to, you know, hear that by the wayside as well, some of the things that you're saying. And a lot of it is in regards to farming, and you're talking about this particular grass that's growing up that's good for the cattle and this and that. And so, you know, now you have the opportunity here, and you may have done this before, so I'm probably ignorant to it, but to talk more about wildlife. And so it's evident to me that you know quite a bit about wildlife and the history of the beaver and all these different things that are important to us as hunters and wildlife managers. So, you know, for me, you know, I just purchased a little under 30 acres. And, you know, the ideal situation is to be pretty well self-sufficient. My wife bought some chicks, and I garden. I like I love my tomatoes. You know,
yes, indeed.
But I'm a hunter through and through. I always have been. And I also happen to really love all types of wildlife, outside of mosquitoes, probably. But
ticks.
And ticks. Those are bad, too. But, you know, I'm not able or willing really just to put up fences or buy the animals and kind of turn my land into grazing pasture. I'm looking more towards the wildlife ag exemptions and that kind of thing. So like I see that wildlife has a spot in the polyface farm as kind of a side effect, but like I guess my question is, how does it fit in? You know, how could you plan that into your own little polyface homestead where, you know, you're not affecting wildlife too much by taking away from the cover that, say, a deer needs or something like that by grazing that pasture?
Yeah, what a great question. I think there's a couple of answers here. One is that whether you have 1 acre or 5,000 acres, you want to work with the terrain to develop lots of edge. As you know, most wildlife needs two environments. The three grand environments are either open land, like, you know, prairie, or forest, or riparian water, which could be anything from a lake to a swamp.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very few species actually like to live in only one. As you know, edge, where these two, where two of these intersect, is always has the most proliferation, the most abundance of wildlife. And so if you Google mapped, aerial mapped our farm, what you would see is a tremendous amount of, for example, you know, wildlife runs where a hillside, a long hillside, maybe 500 yards long, we run a fence down one side, a fence down the other side, and have a 100-yard wild, forestal, and one I'm thinking about, it also has a couple ponds in it and some marshy area. But mm-hmm. The point is, that rather than just letting the animals run willy-nilly through these areas, you actually carve out no livestock zones, and they abut your fields. It might be a steep bank that, you know, you don't feel comfortable driving on with the machinery. It might be something that's too wet. It might be a little spot that, I don't know, maybe there's some rock outcroppings. It's just too rocky, or a gully or something, or, you know, an old wash or a gully that's just a hard piece. So anything that's a hard piece, we let it revert. And so we have miles of these edge fences that define forest and open and open and riparian. And so that allows those buffer zones, those wildlife corridors, to be as abundant as possible. And also then for cover, I mean, you know, birds tend to not feel comfortable settling down and eating more than 200 yards from cover. And so what we've done, we've planted trees and we've fenced out, you know, again, difficult areas. And so we now have cover within 200 yards of all of our open land. So this really makes a patchwork of diversified habitat. And, you know, if you designate hard land to farm in, whether because it's too wet, too dry, too steep, too rocky, you know, whatever the limitation is, if every farm would identify that quote-unquote difficult acreage and let it become a wildlife sector, a wildlife habitat, then suddenly the wildlife is attracted to the habitat, but it utilizes all that surrounding open land, whether it's the turkeys to go out and get grasshoppers for the little ones, the deer to go out and eat clover, whatever that might be, the wildlife proliferates in that spot.
Sure.
So one of the things that we see from our wildlife corridors is that they offer a protection for us from carnivorous predators. And with all these chickens out here in the field, you know, we'd be eaten up. But because we have these designated corridors, they proliferate in chipmunks and voles and moles and all, you know, squirrels and all those things that foxes and coyotes and things like to eat. And so we say our first line of defense, because, you know, one of the first questions when anybody finds out we've got, you know, turkeys and ducks and geese and chickens and stuff, you know, out on pastures, well, what about predators? And the worst habitat you can ever have for a balanced ecosystem is a monospecies, a monocrop, you know, corn and soybeans. That's the worst environment possible. Mm-hmm, but if you start creating a diversified habitat, a mosaic, you're going to start creating a balanced ecosystem, which one of the spinoffs of it is that we feed our foxes and coyotes very well, thank you very much. Wow, I mean, rabbits, we got rabbits, I mean, millions of rabbits, it seems like, but we hunt them, and that actually stimulates their production. Mm-hmm. So, and then, of course, they feed foxes and things like that, too. So the point is, we want to feed those predators very well in our wildlife corridors and our riparian corridors and all that, and the few that can't be satisfied with that go rogue, then we take them out. Mm-hmm. But we only take out those few that can't be satisfied with the habitat we've created.
Sure. So, I guess that was kind of my next question: is do you hunt it? And sounds like you do. Are you managing those wildlife corridors for hunting ever, or is it just? Or, I mean, you say you let them go kind of back. Do you ever do any management or habitat projects in regards to the hunting that you might do on those?
You mean like do we plant some feeding areas and things like that?
That or burn or harvest timber, you know, manage the forest and that kind of thing.
Yeah, great question. So we don't burn here. We're generally it's pretty hard to get a fire going here generally. If you can get a fire going, you probably don't want to start it. So we're a little bit squeamish about that. But mm-hmm. yes, we do a lot of woods work, everything from little, 1 acre clear cuts. We do a fair amount of that. And of course that comes up first in, you know, blueberries and things like that, which attracts bears and all that. So again, the forest, we have uneven age, uneven stuff. So even just a little, you know, if you've got 5 acres of woods, if you go in and just actually clear cut even a quarter acre, half an acre of that, once in, you know, 3 years, so, you know, you're on some sort of a 30-year rotation. You'd be amazed what can be attracted into a little spot like that. What you're trying to do is just you're trying to diversify the vegetation, because a diversified vegetation attracts, you know, different kinds of animals. Hmm. So yeah, we do a lot of work in the woods.
Cool.
Okay, so we do a lot of, or I wouldn't say a lot. We dip our toe into the conservation world quite a bit because we care about wildlife, wild places, and where we live in general, and what God has entrusted into our hands. And I always have this kind of complex, this thing that I think about a lot, about domestication of animals versus just the wild creatures that are already there. So we live in Texas, and you probably know something about the fact that we have a wild hog problem, according to some folks. That's a domesticated animal that has since naturalized and runs wild and free and is doing, you could say, way better than any domestic hog ever got a chance to, right? I mean, they're proliferating beyond belief, right? So, in general, why is it that the cultivation or domestication of animals actually does increase production as opposed to just using the wild creatures that are there for your food or your wool or what have you?
What a great question. I think to answer that, we need to step back for a minute and go back, let's just say, 500 to 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, before the current exponential increase in population, and, you know, when the African plains and the bison roamed on the, you know, in the prairies, and when you go back, what you find is that the megafauna at that time, I mean, we know there were mastodons in Europe, we know there were wombats 9 feet tall in Australia, we know that New Zealand was had tons of these flightless herbivorous birds that are now extinct that were, like, you know, 8 feet tall. The level of megafauna on the planet was so prolific that there were more pounds of megafauna of animal. There were more pounds of animals on the planet 500 years ago than there are pounds of animals today, including if you add all the, so if you add all the human weight, all the Tyson chicken weight, all the, you know, the Cargill beef weight.
We're Bo Pilgrim area down here where we're from, just so you know. But continue. I just messing with you.
Pilgrim's pride, whatever. Okay. So you add all that animal in the world, and we today do not have as much animal weight in the world as there was 500 to 1,000 years ago. Now, as soon as you hear that, you say, well, oh my goodness, why and what can we do to get back to that point? And the reason that was so productive was because of the movement of these animals and the complex relationships, the egret on the rhino's nose, the birds, Audubon. Audubon sat under a tree in, what was it, 1820, and he wrote in his diary, he said, I couldn't see the sun for 3 days for the flock of birds that flew over. Now, the mm-hmm. flock was passenger pigeons, but can you imagine a flock of birds flying over for 3 days so huge that it blocked the sun out for 3 days? I mean, we don't have anything like that today. And, of course, that was before corn and wheat and barley. It was before mm-hmm. all of this stuff. And so where I'm going is that the reason that all that was possible was because the animals had a choreographed movement. They had a choreographed pattern. In fact, my mentor, one of my mentors, Alan Nation, who founded Stockman Grass Farmer, he's passed away now, but he always told me, he said, if you could have taken a drone over the United States 500 years ago, you would have thought that the prairies were fenced with electric fence. Because the bison, and these were massive herds. I mean, I've got a diary quote from a guy in Arkansas in 1870 who climbed up on a high hill, and he saw a herd of bison, and he measured how long it took them to go by him, and he calculated that they were 50 miles long and 20 miles wide, and he said you could not see any prairie in between them.
It's unreal.
Mm. I mean, you cannot imagine, but anyway, Alan said that the grazing patterns, because Native Americans would light fires, fire was used as an attractant for wildlife. Wildlife did not, well, they might have run from fire initially, but in essence, charcoal attracted wildlife because charcoal has a lot of medicinal qualities, a lot of mineral qualities, and so the Native Americans would actually light fires in order to bring wildlife in, to attract them in, so the burned over areas, they picked over the charred embers, charred pieces. And so fire, when fire struck, of course, there wasn't any fire department, and it would burn wherever there was enough extra vegetation, extra biomass to burn. And of course, it didn't burn a straight line. You know, it didn't burn like the roads and fences laid out in Kansas and Nebraska. It burned all sorts of, you know, crazy patterns. And the bison would graze, because that freshened up the grass, it would attract the bison several months later, and the bison would come, and those herds would literally graze up to those burn edges as specifically as if there were an electric fence there.
Hmm.
So where I'm going with this is that when you add the water, the beavers, the diversity, the symbiosis, the movement, that whole choreography, that's why it was so abundant. So the question is, can we today we don't have bison. Today we can't let the beavers, you know, dam up Manhattan. Manhattan probably wouldn't like it very much.
No.
So how do we duplicate all of that incredible management template that prey and predator and multi-speciation, weather patterns, seasons, fires, hunting, the Native Americans, you know, how can we duplicate that with domestic livestock? That's the burning question at Polyface Farm. That's what we do. That's what we spend our lives doing. And we may not have completely accomplished it, but I think we've come at least as close as anybody I've seen to so we use electric fence. Electric fence becomes our predator and our fire barrier. And so electric fence puts a steering wheel, a brake pedal, and a gas pedal on that four-legged pruner, and we can steer them around the landscape with the same precision as a zero-turn mower on a golf course. That's never been possible in human history. But that's only being done with, I don't know, I'm just going to shoot from the hip here and say, with perhaps 4 to 5% of the world's herbivores.
Mm-hmm.
If it were done with 100%, you would see an abundance that you can't even imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And so our whole deal, when people think we're very creative, we say, you know, we're not creative. All we're creative about is trying to adapt these ancient wild templates to a domestic model so that we can enjoy that same, you know, that same abundance. And so what does it do for us? So to document the abundance, I'll just give you the statistic. In Augusta County, where we live, the average cow days per acre, and of course a cow day is what one cow will eat in a day. So if you took all the food you eat today, Tyler, and put it on a plate, that would be one person day of food. So what one cow eats in a day is one cow day of food. And in our county, the average on pasture is 80 cow days per acre. In other words, an acre will support 80 cows for one day, or one cow for 80 days a year. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right. So here, our average is 400 cow days per acre.
Oh, man.
And we've never planted a seed, and we've never bought a bag of chemical fertilizer. So that's not bragging. That is simply paying humble homage to an exquisitely and infinitely perfect design that it's our responsibility to, you know, to learn about and to duplicate the best we can.
Yeah. You know, design's a word you don't hear thrown around in scientific circles very often. So I appreciate you using that. You know, we believe in a divine creator who did, you know, specifically designed this place that we live. And
Yes. When
you start looking at things that way, it's really going to change your perspective, because the modern man, the misconception of modern man being the most advanced man is what is the driver of today's world, right? Everyone thinks that they're the new smartest generation that's ever hit the floor, and it's just not the case. It's not at all the case, right? So,
absolutely.
Then that's why we have this system of agriculture and these removed industries that do their own thing, and these monocultures and these wildlife deserts of agriculture, right?
Right.
And people think that it's the best. How do you convince people that it's not the best conceptually, but then also actually convert them? Because I'm sure you're surrounded by other farms where you're at. You know, it's an agricultural area of the country. Can you even start with your neighbor, much less, you know, Joe Missouri over here who's growing corn? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, there are a few things as unappreciated as unsolicited advice.
Yeah.
And so I mean, look, we have a wonderful community here, you know, wonderful folks. I always say, you know, our neighbor farmers, you know, I trust them with my granddaughter and I trust them with my bank account. I just don't trust them with the land or my food supply.
That's pretty good.
And so, you know, they're salt of the earth people. They're you know, great folks. But we just see the world completely differently. I'll give you just one example as a thread. For example, they if something gets sick, an animal, let's say, if an animal gets sick, they immediately assume that they need some sort of a pharmaceutical, some sort of a medication that animal is lacking some sort of a medication.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's sick. When we have an animal get sick, we assume that we undermined the immunological function somehow. Now, it could be we chose the wrong parents, you know, genetically. It could be that we weren't sanitary enough, that we let them, you know, eat over their own poop. Mm-hmm. It could be that we stressed them. They were uncomfortable, too hot, too cold, too wet, too whatever. I mean, there's a million ways to stress an immune system. And so the point that I'm making is to the conventional orthodox farmer of today, nature is fundamentally flawed, and we have to better it, fix it, change it, repair it. We've got to do something to it to make it right. Our belief is nature is fundamentally well, and if it's not well, we probably did something that messed it up.
Mm-hmm.
And those two ways of looking at disease and looking at wellness are as different as night and day. They couldn't be more opposite. And so you know, we come from a very different a very different paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, so we don't argue, people come to this one little thing at a time. I mean, you know, it's so interesting. I just got a call 2 nights ago actually from a fella in Illinois. He grows 5,000 acres of corn, beans, and rice. And he said, since last fall, and he's, you know, he's not a spring chicken. He's, you know, he's in his 40s, but he's, you know, like third generation on this farm, and he's working with his family and stuff. And said, since last fall, he has just gradually become aware that this can't be right. This can't be right for the land.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear that. The thing is, people come to it individually. Lots of times there's some health tragedy. You know, a spouse gets cancer. You know, there's some sort of a medical tragedy that pushes somebody into a search. But sometimes, too, I had a guy tell me, he said he was a produce grower. And he said, I converted the day that I was walking through my carrots, and I realized I was afraid to pick one up and just brush it on my pants and eat it. And it was this aha moment. What am I doing that I can't even go over and pick a carrot, brush it off on my britches and eat it?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that set him down to a new path of, you know, no chemicals and different things. So, you know, everybody's kind of testimony, the coming to this is a different story, but there's usually some event in life that, because look, who goes around wanting to change their routine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. That's nobody, none of us.
Somebody gets up in the morning and says, you know, I've always had, you know, whatever for breakfast, and I'm suddenly going to change. Or I've, you know, or goes to the store and says, well, I've always been a Pantene Pro V guy, but today I'm going to buy a Head and Shoulders. I mean, no, people don't change their routines, and so yeah,
especially when there's work involved.
yeah, and especially when it can threaten your belief system.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, here's the deal. I love it, man. I love exactly where you're at, but without converting the world instantaneously, there's a separate problem going on out there that's outside of your control. And, you know, suddenly one day some bovine-borne disease shows up on your farm, and it's been created because someone else is feeding, you know, dead cows to live cows or whatever, and it's just completely out of your control. You know, is there a circumvention for that, or is that just, are you just kind of at the mercy of other people's sins at that point?
Another great question. So we believe fundamentally in immunological function, and we have had numerous cases over the years where our animals rub noses with neighbors' animals. That one year we had a neighbor that lost 500 pound calves to coccidiosis in a field adjoining our pastured chickens. And these were pastured chickens. I mean, these were little chicks. We're going out with meat chickens at, you know, at 14 days old in the adjoining pasture. And, of course, you know, the vet says, well, it was brought in by Canada geese. You know, and, of course, Canada geese are all over. Of course, Canada geese came on our place as well as his. And here they knocked down six of his 500-pound cattle. And we didn't have a single thing, even something way more vulnerable, a little chick, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I could give you that story several times over the years. We've had numerous examples of that, and so we just really believe that a properly functioning immune system is the best. Is better than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Sir Albert Howard, I don't know if you guys ever heard of Sir Albert Howard, but he's kind of the godfather of today's organic or, you know, ecological farming movement. He basically invented modern scientific composting. His career spanned about 1920 to 1950, and he was primarily assigned as an agricultural guy. This is India before India, when India was still a protectorate under Great Britain, British Empire, and before Gandhi. And he went there to run the agricultural experiment station in Indore, India. And they had a hoof and mouth outbreak in their cattle in India. At the time, in the whatever the 30s, and he over 10 years, he replicated a research project where he got two adjoining corrals. He put, you know, 20 cows in one, 20 cows in the other, and in both groups he put in a hoof and mouth carrier, a diseased cow.
Mm-hmm.
And the one group he fed chemically fertilized hay. So this was cut and carry. And so they were, you know, they were mowing grass nearby, and they were bringing it in probably on an ox cart and putting it in mangers, you know, and feeding these cows in these two corrals. And one came from a field that he was fertilizing with chemical fertilizer. The other group was fed from hay grown on with grass that was fertilized with compost. He developed the composting system, call it the indoor method. And over the replicate, he did it duplicated several times, and he never had a single cow in the compost-fertilized hay corral get hoof and mouth, which, as you know, is extremely communicable.
Mm-hmm.
And at the on the other side, not all of them got it, but lots of them did.
Hmm.
Whereas on the compost-fertilized side, he never had a single one get it. And so his whatever conclusion from the experiment was that hoof and mouth was a dietary problem. It was a nutritional problem. It was simply a nutritional problem. It was not some, you know, evil minded fairy sprinkling hoof and mouth woba dust down on on cattle farmers.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to take them out. And you guys probably remember several years ago when Great Britain had, you know, a huge outbreak of hoof and mouth.
Yep.
In fact, there were so many thousands of cattle burned on farms that the whole country stunk so much that they lost basically a season of tourism to England because of the stench in the countryside burning all these cows.
Hmm.
And I remember very well at the time, you know, realizing, because I'm a big fan of Sir Albert Howard, and thinking, what a tragedy that they can't just get their nutrition right and deal with it that way. No, instead they've got to exterminate everything. But that's the modern orthodoxy to everything. Doesn't matter what it is. You know, it's cut, burn, annihilate, incinerate. You know, it's kill it.
Yeah.
Instead of realizing that the disease is simply an opportunistic something that is leveraging a weakness that probably people created.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, that's a very, very different way of looking at things. So do I fear avian? I mean, you know, the last time high-path avian influenza went through, Southeast Asia, through India, Pakistan, it knocked on the door of Europe, actually. There was actually a group in Great Britain that did a study on it, and they found that if a chicken eats two fresh blades of grass a day, it won't get high path avian influenza.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Now, there again, wouldn't you think that somebody, some official, you know, high up would say, hey, there's nothing to be afraid of, folks. Let's just change our production model.
Yeah.
But of course nobody says that. They want to make a vaccine or a medication or a drug or annihilate, 5 million chickens. And that's the way we do things. And I'm being very careful to not bring up coronavirus. I just did.
It's on everyone's mind.
But obviously the kind of things that I'm saying about animals have absolute application to any sickness at any time.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you drink from cattle troughs.
That's exactly. That's why I drink raw milk, drink from the cattle trough, wipe the carrot on my britches, eat some of that dirt. You know, I figure all those microbes in that dirt, when I eat them, they go down and they commiserate with their cousins down in my microbiome, And I can just see this whole, family reunion going on. Hey, cousin, I haven't seen you for so long,
Yeah, you don't have to have some packaged yogurt to give you your enzymes, I'm guessing. Man, it's, so many things. And I guess the crazy thing, you bring up coronavirus. That's the world we live in right now. We don't like to talk about it much because I mean, there's just so much fear-mongering going on that I just don't want to contribute to that in the least little bit, right? And instead, I like to spread...
And we're also just tired of it.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
I mean, that's half the reason why Texas is opening up. Everybody's just like, whatever, we'll risk it. We're tired of this crap, you know?
That's right. You can't make people anti-human but so long.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally get tired of it. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, no, it's fine. You know, it's funny you say it because Tyler and I just took a flight for the first time since, you know, the pandemic happened. And they made you wear masks on the plane, you know, whatever. I'll comply because I'm using your service. That's the way it works. But you go in the airport and they have all these lines for social distancing and all that. And no one gives a flip. No one's wearing a mask. You know, like,
no. It's
over, man. Like, you know, and I know that people... like to say it's not, and I understand there probably is an inherent danger for quite a few members of the population, but I mean it's just going to happen. It just is what it is, you know. And we have to develop your personal immunity, or how did you? What's the word you like to use? Something about
biome.
It starts with the I, right? What's the word you like to use?
Well, I mean, I like to use, you know, immunity. Herd immunity.
Yeah.
Is the word that, you know, a lot of the functional medicine doctors use.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we've got to build up that microbiome, and you don't do that with Coca-Cola.
No.
and Pop-Tarts and you know, Cheez-Its.
Yeah. Yeah, you hurt Tyler's feelings with the Pop-Tart thing.
But. I do like a Pop-Tart on a cold morning in the deer stand, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to go down a little path here, all right? I've heard you state that you do believe that your method of farming can feed the world. And I believe you when you say it, but what does that world look like? Is that the world where we have this propped up system where you have 7.5 billion people who a lot of them are living on government subsidies and, you know, genetically engineered crops and this and that? And do you mean the world of 9 billion people that we're going to have in 10 years? Or do you mean a more homeostatic world that's kind of in balance where we don't have this ever growing human population and maybe it's even less than what we have now?
Yeah, well, let's that's a big question. There's a lot to unpack. So let's unpack a little bit of it off the top end, just to appreciate that the explosive growth on the planet is not occurring very many places. The only place where it's still occurring is in extremely vulnerable, impoverished areas,
mm-hmm.
where people are scared that there might not be enough people to take care of them when they get older. But in the more wealthy part of the world, including China, I mean, shoot, you know, Singapore, you know, if you have a child, Singapore will pay you. You know, and China's doing some of this as well. Actually, in much of the world, there aren't enough babies to maintain the population.
Yeah, so, Eastern Europe has a big problem with this, right?
That's right. Well, yeah. And the U.S. is it if it weren't for immigration in the U.S., we would be going backwards as well. So, so the what happens is, a lot of times, prophecies don't occur because they awaken people, and then the there's a response to the prophecy that actually negates the prophecy. You know, like Y2K. You know, we're all going to be bombed back into barbarian caveman Y2K, and everybody knuckled down and handled it, and there was no Y2K issue. And so
it's not true. My New Year's Eve thing glitched for like 10 seconds. The TV stopped working, but then we got it back. So when you say none, it's too much of an absolute. You got to clarify.
Yeah. Okay. So where the population is going, I think right now is not a signed done deal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there is that the trajectory of it's just going to continue to grow. There's going to be 7 and then 8 and then 9 and then 10. You know, that's actually not being borne out in the data trajectory of the last 20 years. But of course, you know, fear sells well, sensationalism sells well, so mm-hmm. we can get people scared. You know, they'll accept almost anything, including GMOs and chemical fertilizers, and you know, fake meat and all sorts of things. So the population is in question. Number two, what does that world look like? So what that world would look like is that we would probably grow less than half, maybe even only a third of the grain that we're producing, corn and soybeans especially, around the world. We certainly wouldn't grow corn for ethanol, and we wouldn't feed any grains to herbivores, and all herbivores would be on prairie and moved every day. And at that level of management, the production is identical to corn and soybeans. So the only reason people think, well, grass farming can't feed the world is because their data source is based on continuous grazing, the kind that you see, you know, 95 to 97% of farmers doing, continuous grazing, no rotation, and overgrazing, desertification, and all 9 yards, you know, riparian dysfunction, habitat destruction, the whole 9 yards. And that's the data source that's being used to impugn the viability of a perennial prairie-based herbivore nutrition system. So my world would look a lot like that. Mm-hmm. Then the second part would be that food production and processing and the waste streams would be integrated. They would not be segregated. Today, the animals are locked up in a house. They're fed feed that's trucked in from somewhere else, that's grown with fertilizer that's trucked in from somewhere else, and they're consumed somewhere else, and the waste stream goes into landfills. All of that would be integrated in my world. Historically, pigs and chickens on the homestead were scavengers. They ate the garden stuff. They ate spoiled milk from the cow, skim milk from the cow. I mean, whey from cheese making. I mean, the fact that 75% of landfill weight is biodegradable, and some 30% of landfill weight is food, edible food material, or at least it was edible at one time, you know, that is just, it's morally unconscionable that we would throw away the very feedstock that historically supported a menagerie, an integrated menagerie in a community. And so, for example, a restaurant would have a chicken house attached to it. And all the food scraps come out of there, feed the chickens. The eggs go into the restaurant. Now the restaurant doesn't have to get eggs from a chicken factory. Nobody has to drive on a road to deliver the eggs. And the food scraps don't have to go to the landfill or a recycling bin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that kind of integration. I mean, goodness, when Pat Forman wrote City Chicks about urban backyard chicken flocks, she did the math and realized that if one-third of American households had enough chickens to eat their kitchen scraps, their food scraps, there would not be an egg industry in the United States. In fact, she points out that there was a city in Belgium, in Europe, that offered three chickens to any household that wanted three chickens. And 2,000 families signed up, so they bought 6,000 chickens, and they gave three of them to these 2,000 households. And in the first month, it dropped landfill waste stream by 100 tons.
Oh, man.
So, and of course, those chickens produced eggs.
Sure.
The eggs didn't have to be grown in factories, and they weren't fed corn and soybeans. So the integrated as opposed to the segregated model, that's the way nature does. You guys know that nature doesn't have landfills. Nature doesn't have, you know, waste streams.
Mm-hmm.
There's always, even if it's a microbe or a worm, something eats everything. And
yeah.
and there's nothing in wildlife. Nobody in wildlife has the privilege of waking up in the morning and saying, I don't think I'll participate. No frog ever woke up in the morning on the edge of a pond and said, you know, I don't think I'm going to participate. And yet humans routinely wake up in the morning and opt to not participate, to not think consciously, to not appreciate a moral dimension to mm-hmm. to their menu, to what's happening. They routinely wake up and say, I won't participate. In nature, that's not possible.
Yeah.
And I'm suggesting that in my world, everybody would wake up in the morning and ask, how do I participate? How do I increase earthworms? How do I increase potable water? How do I increase breathable air? How do I increase biomass and you know, the carbon cycle? You know, how do we do that?
Mm-hmm.
So those are just a couple threads. I mean, I could talk for a long, long time answering that, what that world looks like. But as you can just, as I've ticked off just a couple of things, you can appreciate, yes, is it doable? Absolutely. Do we know how to do it? Absolutely. We don't need any more research. We don't need any more resources. We don't need anything. All we need to do is tweak our models, and it can change dramatically today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, society has a cyclical nature where, for instance, you say an 1850s homestead, you have a extended family most likely living somewhere on the prairie, and they provide for themselves. And then at some point in time, they figure out a way to travel to market or to, you know, St. Louis or whatever the gateway is at that point in time. And they can sell goods and exchange goods. And then sooner or later, they specialize because they realize that their farm grows, you know, hogs very well. And then suddenly, they don't even have, you know, their own egg chickens. They just grow hogs completely because their neighbor has chickens. And then sooner or later you get to the point where, well, I'm going to grow all the hogs for the community. And then, you know what? Man, the community likes that, but those hogs are stinky. So you know what? As a community, we need to create regulations to keep this guy from having these hogs in this part of town. And then you just have this whole governmental interference that repeats itself over and over again. How do you keep that from just in that cycle from repeating itself?
Yeah, well, I mean, the only thing I know is an ecology ethic, and we don't have an ecology ethic in our country.
Europeans. Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We came to a place with 8 feet of topsoil, a place of abundance, and we just, well, Sir Albert Howard says it's the temptation of every generation to take what nature spent 1,000 years creating and turn it into cash in one generation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a profound insight. And I don't know how you, you know, I don't know how if I could shake a magic wand and make people wake up tomorrow with an ecology ethic, I'd do it. But I don't think anybody's figured out
how
to make it. It's one at a time. It's one, and that's one reason why we have such an aggressive publicity, channel here at the farm. We have about 15,000 visitors a year. We do lunatic tours. We do seminars. We do events. We know that when a person comes here and does one of our tours or takes one of our seminars, they never think the same way again. I tried to explain where we are in a couple of my books. One is Folks, This Ain't Normal, and yeah. One is The Sheer Ecstasy of Being a Lunatic Farmer. but there's nothing like seeing it. There's nothing like actually, immersing yourself in it. And so does it take time to handle people and deal with people? And all, sure it does, but we know that when people see it and immerse in it for even just for a day or for, for a tour, they never look at it the same way again. I've had people call me afterwards and complain, you sure messed our lives up. We can't even drive down the countryside and enjoy it anymore. Look at that guy overgrazing. Look at that dolly over there. Look at that.
That's funny.
Well done.
You ruined our Sunday afternoon drive.
Oh my goodness. So you talk about the ecological ethic that we kind of need. What about work ethic? I mean, is the style of farming in which you embark, do you feel like you have to work harder because of that style? As opposed to somebody who's got a monoculture type farm.
No, I certainly understand, you sprint all summer or you have your great big magnificent machine and then you go to the Caribbean for the winter, primarily because you've gotten some sort of government subsidy. I get all that. And of course I didn't say it, but in the world that I would envision, there would not be a USDA. Mm-hmm. I call it the US duh. there would not be a US duh. I mean, it just wouldn't exist. There's never been a government agency more successful at annihilating its constituency than the U.S. duh. But anyway, the idea that people can can participate, can grow this, and can be involved in it. It's a powerful thing, and that desire to emotionally connect is what makes this work enjoyable. We're not rich. We make good, but we don't drive a Porsche by any means. I have no desire to drive a Porsche.
Me neither.
What I desire? I desire that constant feedback and phone calls from our patrons who say, thank you for keeping us alive. I can tell it in my body when I eat your meat. It's the closest thing to, venison that I've ever had. I mean, whatever the thing is. We appreciate that. And so, does this put more people on the land? Absolutely. Does it take more people in farms? Absolutely. But does it require any pharmaceuticals? No. So the pharmaceutical folks, they can come out and help butcher chickens, we got lots of work here. We got lots of work here to do. We don't spray herbicide on our multiflora rose and autumn olive. We chop them with mattocks. That takes time and effort. But at least we're not chemicalizing the landscape. So the bottom line is, there's more to life than money, and there's certainly more meaning in work than seeing how little of it you can do. And if your situation does not have a sacredness to its work that that makes you want to do more of it because it's sacred and noble, then it's understandable why you'd want to do less of it.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But the cure is not doing less of it. It is discovering and finding work that has a nobility and a sacredness to it, so that your work feeds your soul. Mm-hmm. It's not just a way of making a living.
Yeah. What's the key to a man finding his purpose?
I think that you have to experiment with numerous things. That's one reason why we believe in child entrepreneurism. So that you know, as early as possible, you start interacting with the adult world and trying your hand at different things, learning about profit and loss and customer feedback, that sort of thing. Learn, and then beyond that, I think it's knowing what floats your boat. I think the average person never gives themselves the freedom, the liberty to dream. You know, we grow up and we learn to obey, and then, or hopefully you learn to obey, parents, and then you learn to toe the line with the whatever Sunday school teacher, your school teacher, and maybe that could be your parents as well, and then you get a little older and you learn to toe the line with a coach or with, you know, whatever else that you're dealing with. And then you kind of go to college, maybe, and you do what makes a professor happy, and guidance counselors, and then you get a job, and you try to please the employer. My point is, our whole trajectory, our continuum, is finding fulfillment in doing what somebody else wants us to do. And I think that the average person comes to adulthood never giving themselves license, mm-hmm. permission, maybe would be a better word, never giving ourselves permission to actually sit and say, if money were not an option and time were not an option, what would I do tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
We don't permit ourselves to ask that question because we don't think it's something that we could ever do, because we've grown up learning that our personal affirmation is based on somebody else's desire for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So, what to give somebody like maybe a little bit of positivity or some direction? Kind of as we close out, like, what's the thing that someone can wake up and do tomorrow to better this world? Let's say at least in this space we're talking about here.
Right, right. So, yeah, so I always have a kind of, my recipe is three things. I can do them pretty quickly. The first one is do something yourself. Participate in the majesty and miracle mystery of life. It might be nothing more than a little earthworm kit under your sink to put your kitchen scraps in. It might be a tomato plant on the patio. It might be, I don't know, but participating in the majesty and mystery of life is a very humbling, grounding, connecting experience to our ecological umbilical, just to realize that there's more going on than me, that there's something bigger than me out there. I think that is almost the beginning of wisdom and the beginning of actual self-satisfaction, is learning that there's a universe out here that's amazing, that's way beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
That's so. Grow something. Do something yourself. In your food or production sphere. Number two, get in your kitchen, and this is not just to women. This is to everybody. Get in your kitchen. We've never had more techno-gadgetized kitchens than now. I'm not talking about, you know, going to the spring with a wooden bucket and bringing it to the cook stove to get hot water. We now have hot and cold tap water. We've got refrigerators, freezers, microwaves, time bake, Instapots, ice cream makers, bread makers, you know, slurry makers, blenders, beaters. So, I mean, we've never had all these gadgets. So get in your kitchen and begin buying unprocessed and use your kitchen to prepare, process, package, and preserve food so you actually create your own larder, your own pantry, your own participatory culinary work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Number three is turn off the TV, turn off Netflix, and devote some time that you would normally spend being a couch potato and spend that time visiting some local farms. Get in touch with your local authentic food production, integrity food production, farming community. There are more of us out here now than there have ever been. Every city is surrounded by good farmers. And if you visit 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you'll begin developing a skill. You'll understand the lingo, the jargon, and before you know it, you'll become skilled at discernment because you'll, that guy said this, this guy said that, this guy has this, this guy looks like this, this place looks like that. And suddenly what is right now a paralyzing, enigmatic world actually becomes a skilled, discerning, wise connection for you. And as you develop that, you then begin loading your food dollars and your patronage into farms that like frogs, farms that like worms, yeah. Farms that like, you know, skunks and deer and badgers and whatever. And as you load those dollars into those, that will be the dog that grows. You know, the old Native American question, the little boy, you know, had two puppies. And he asked his grandfather, he said, Grandpa, you know, which puppy is going to grow better? Grandpa says, the one you feed. And so if we, the world as we have it today is a physical manifestation of billions and billions and billions of choices and decisions that individuals have made leading up to today. The world that our grandchildren will inherit will also be comprised of the billions and quadrillions of daily decisions that you and I make. So if we start making the right decisions today, it will change the legacy, the landscape legacy that our grandchildren will inherit. And if that isn't a noble goal, I don't know what is.
That's awesome, man. What so many words of wisdom in this podcast, and I can't thank you enough, Joel, for coming on and doing this with us, man. This is, we've probably done 200 interviews throughout the course of our podcast, and this is maybe one of my favorite ever, for sure. So appreciate you coming on. What's the best place to send people who might want to see the books?
Sure. We have a website, Polyface Farm.
Okay.
P-O-L-Y. If you just put in P-O-L-Y, probably it'll come on up the rest of it. Polyface Farm's website has all sorts of things, whether you want to get books, if you want to order food, if you want, you know, a T-shirt that says everything I want to do is illegal on it.
You know, I wanted to rail on the government for another 30 minutes, but I think we better save that for another episode if you want to.
let's save that for another time. Anyway, yeah, Polyface Farms is the website, and a lot of information on there, and everybody's welcome to jump on that and see what they want.
Awesome. So does the name Polyface, is that mean like multifaceted farm? Is that what you're going for?
Yes, our logo, if you jump on that website, our logo is a tree and a cow and a chicken and a fish. And so when we started, you know, back in 1980. I mean, our family came in 61, but we didn't start Polyface until Therese and I got married and came back and wanted to make a living on the farm. We wanted to be interface, the riparian, forestal, and open land interface. When we submitted it to the State Corporation Commission, it got rejected because there was already an interface incorporated in Virginia. Of course, curiosity killed the cat. We said, "Who in the world?" You know, and it turned out that it was a labor arbitrator. You know, between management and labor. You know, mm-hmm. they deal with labor disputes.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I was milking the old Guernsey cow. You know, Dad walked in. Well, we got a letter. We got rejected. You know. And I said, I mean, just like that, I mean, just it hit me. I said, well, if we can't be interfaced, let's be many-faced. We'll be polyfaced. And we loved it, and it struck. So, yeah, so there we are. Many-faced.
That's awesome. Awesome, man. Well, we will link to that in the show notes. So if you're listening, feel free to go click on that. And, Joel, I hope you have a great summer, man. I appreciate you spending time with us.
Thank you. It's been a delight to be with you.
Yes, sir. All right, so follow me on this. Joel talked a lot about beavers, and you mentioned this in the intro. The dude knows a lot about wildlife, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He started talking about beavers the size of Volkswagens.
Yeah.
Okay. You've bow fished quite a bit in your life, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever been in the dark with some lights on the front of the boat, and all of a sudden this giant figure just comes out of the dark, and it's a beaver, and it scares you half to death?
Oh, yeah.
Think about a Volkswagen size beaver.
No kidding, dude. Be into nuts.
The lights. That was the first thing I thought when he's like, beavers the size of Volkswagen.
Crazy.
I was like, dude, I've been scared by some beavers before.
Yeah.
And they were not Volkswagens.
Yeah. What's what also is cool is Joel hinted at the concept of an Earth that might not be 6 billion years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of interesting.
It was interesting.
We're going to have to get Joel on the podcast again one of these days because there's a whole bunch that we can still cover that I'd like to talk to him about.
Oh, we could have talked forever. Joel, I know, is an extremely busy guy, and we were trying to be conscious of his time, so we definitely were trying to limit how much time we spent on the phone with him.
I've done a little farming in my day, and by about 8 p.m., you're ready for bed whenever you're doing some farming.
It's 3:59 right now, and I'm ready for bed. Just so you know.
I got about a 10-minute nap while it goes, so I feel pretty good.
I slept a long time last night, and I still am not recovered from just the last few weeks, but
good.
I fell asleep in my clothes last night, probably about 8:30 or 9, and
that was like right after I left your house.
Dude, I laid down and was watching TV with Journey,
mm-hmm.
and fell asleep and woke up in my clothes at like 6:45 this morning, still in my clothes.
Man,
it's been a long time since I slept in fully clothed, fully clothed body.
Yeah, so, you're pretty tired.
Yeah, I
pretty
was pretty
tired.
Still am too. I don't know. It's almost like I've not been tireder today, but like the middle of the day was tough, man.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, today you were inside most of the middle of the day.
That might have been.
And there was maybe some not as excited voices.
There was definitely. We found that out as soon as you got on a mic.
Yeah, man, there's nothing puts you to sleep faster than, you know, a 1 p.m. chemistry class or whatever.
Be
you
know,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you know.
Yeah. So, anyway. The one thing that I've been working on a lot here lately, we have a ton of YouTube content that is not released yet. Very scared to do so because it's great information, guys, about public land hotspots, the Map Scout Challenge, some cool stuff that we're working on. And this stuff will come out in the next couple of months or so. But right now, what we've been releasing are just like highlights from the season and some of the fun moments that we got to kind of live through. So if you didn't see all the videos from the season, it might be worth checking out. And even if you did and you were hype, you know, 6 months ago or whenever it was, now you can be hype again.
That's right. It's hype season.
It is hype season, dude. And like, you don't want to burn out, you know, so if you're that kind of guy, then you may need to hold off for a month or two. But
I'm not, dude. I can get hype and maintain.
You know when Cody Beaver gets hype, it's time.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
that dude is season to season, man. Mm-hmm. It's either big bass or big deer with him. But
that's right.
Anyway, yeah, go check out those videos. We've got a couple or one up of a giant elk, a couple up of some big deer, got another one of – dude, okay, so let me talk about this. I told you this last night, but – one of the videos that's going to come out is the video where you almost killed on, like, day 9 of the elk hunt, you know? And this big 5 comes in, and I didn't realize how many times he bugled at, like, 30 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And then he literally comes to 20 and he's in thick, thick stuff. And, but like when he's first coming into 20, he's probably like 25 or so. There's this epic video shot that, cause I'm right behind you and you can see like half your head. It's like your hair and kind of the profile of your hat, you know? And then the bull is in this perfect little window of stuff. And he like got his head down real low, looking through the window of stuff up the hill. Mm-hmm. And he's like staring a hole through your soul and you're doing the same to him. Like y'all are just locked at like 25 yards, you know? And he's just, and you're like, he sees us. And then he keeps on coming like after a few seconds. But that like shot of you, part of your head, and then the window with him looking through at you with his head down, like, I think it's one of the coolest shots I had last year as a camera guy. But at the same time, like, you can't put it in a thumbnail and anybody understand what's going on there. Because yeah. It just looks like your hair is just a bush. You know what I mean? It's like, you can't understand
it
that that's a head.
It kind of is that way, but
it
yeah.
is. But, like, when there's movement in the camera, you see, oh, that's Casey's head, mm-hmm. you know? But in a still picture, it does not convey.
No.
And it crushed me, man, to not be able to put that as, like, the thumbnail for that, man.
Yeah. Well, but maybe next year I'll dye my hair, like, orange or something. That way you can tell what
your shoelaces have to be pink, right?
They do.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about that. I might start that October 1st for the whitetail hunt.
It's a good idea.
Just because I don't want pink shoelaces, but I don't want to have to unlace my real mountain boots. I like the way they are.
You definitely don't want
to mess
those
with those.
No.
Yeah. So I'll probably just wait until whitetail season.
I'll allow it, but you got to ask Brian about that.
He's that fool nothing.
Dude, he is just made sure that we're not going to forget that, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's all right. But he's old. He'll forget, too.
Come on, Brian.
He ain't going to listen this far into this podcast anyways.
Nope. He doesn't like things outside of birds.
That's right, dude. Yeah, he's gonna be out of here by the time that
he likes pigs now, though.
He does.
Wild ones.
That's right, man.
Anyway, well, guys, I hope you enjoyed that, man. I know we did a lot. This is something we're getting into a little more of, and hopefully that'll help us out as we kind of pursue, I guess, what the dream is, kind of the American dream. I know a lot of people outside of America probably dream of that, too, but definitely something we here have thought about a lot. So anyway, hope this summer is going well for you guys. I hope to see you on the other side of this trip that I'm going to take, maybe with some Gulf Bay fishing pictures and that kind of thing. And remember, this is your element.
Living it.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.